Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Christy Ellis.
Hi, Christy.
Happy Sunday.
Thank you.
Really can't think of anywhere I'd rather be than with you wonderful people. This is my favorite place to be. I'm at my best when I'm with you, and I thank you for being part of my recovery today. My sobriety date is April 12, 1988. I have a sponsor that I do talk to very regularly, and thank God I got her, because I'm 18 and a half years sober almost, and I don't know how it is to be 19 years sober, so I need her desperately in my life. And I use her, and she helps me a lot, and we actually help each other probably. I have a home group, the principal's group. We meet twice a week. They're both closed meetings, and they're grounded in the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous. One's in the big book, and the other's in Language of the Heart and other literature. And we spend a great many hours together studying the big book and sharing recovery, experience, strength, and hope, and how we stay in this wonderful world of living. Didn't know much about that before I got here, and I'm grateful to be a part of it today. I'm going to do what I'm told to do, and that's I'm going to qualify, basically, because my favorite part's about recovery, but you need to know that I did earn my seat. So I'm not going to over-talk about drunk stuff, but I am going to let you know that I thought, drank, and felt just like you. And that's the bottom line, that we did. I don't care. We all got there different ways, but we all got there. I know I did. And I stayed there a long time before I found the rooms of AA. And a way out of that hell I've been living in for so many years. And I know it's only through the steps and the principles and working with others and all the stuff that they told me the minute I got here that it works. And if I keep doing it every day, I can keep it. And that's the deal, because it is one day at a time for sure. I'm the oldest of four. I was born in Bon Air, Virginia. I'm a Bon Airian, that's what I call myself. Bon Air's in Chesterfield. I was very caught up in that south of the James, north of the James, all that stuff in Richmond growing up because it was a title. It defined me, all those little things I used to define who I was because I didn't know who I was or even like who I was. But I was born and raised in Bon Air, Virginia, the oldest of four. I've got great parents. We had the best of everything. The reason I tell you that is because I had it all, and most kids would have died to have my life, and it wasn't enough. It's because this thing's not about the outside. You know, it's all about the inside. I remember very early in life being very insecure, trying to fill the inside with outside stuff. When I got sober, I started calling that the God-shaped hole. Didn't mean I didn't believe in God, but I didn't have God inside. So I was always reaching out of me to fill it up. Tried to join a lot of things through my early childhood to try to be something, because I thought I had to be something. And I wasn't good at it right away, so quit and did something else. Very tolerant mother. She was really very a commitment-oriented person, so she was very tolerant about me retrying all these things. Piano was probably the only thing she made me stick with, and I just hated practicing every day for 15 big minutes. And I'd play in recitals and things, and I was actually good at it, but I wasn't the best. But because she told me it was something I had to do, I was rebellious before I even drank. I didn't want to do it, you know, because somebody was telling me what to do. But I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. I always wanted to be you, be over there. Try to do something that I didn't have my hands on. And I was so worried about being involved and included that I never realized that all the time I was included. I was always included. But I was so consumed with what you were thinking about me and including me that I never realized it, if that makes sense. And I say all that because that mindset, before I even poured the alcohol in, which actually was the answer for quite a while, but that opened up all the doors so that I did feel like I was included. Because that was such a big deal. I used to say on my tombstone, I was going to say, don't forget about me, you know, and that was the thing, you know, don't forget, I want to be there, you know, and oh, yeah, I am here. Okay, well, I'm going to be over there, you know, always looking. But anyway, all through, until I was 14, that's when I took my first drink. I had three younger brothers, and we went to church, and we had the family vacations and the great house and the nice life, and it was wonderful. It really was. You ate at 5:30, and you better be there. You helped with the dishes, even though there was a dishwasher. You know, my mother was raised very poor, so she made sure her kids had a lot of everything. So it was nothing, you know, for me to come home and find clothes on the bed with matching shoes. I just had it all, but I wasn't grateful because I still wanted something else. And I was just a seeker. I was the early 70s when I was a teenager, and I was sitting around the flagpole in eighth grade chanting, and we were going in the girls' bathroom, learning how to smoke cigarettes, French inhaling, doing the smoke rings. And I always liked all the guys who got in trouble for some reason. And I was attracted to those people, you know, and they're fun, they're exciting, they're living on the edge, it makes my adrenaline go, I want it, I want more, you know. And so I went after that, and it was almost like I had to like so many people to fill that hole inside of me, and But anyway, when I was 14, my mom threw us in a private school. We were far into the county, but was worried about all this stuff going on, and threw us in this private school. And I, of course, I'm hooked up with some people that like to live on the edge, because at that, I had been kind of a goody-goody up till 12 or 13, but then I started changing. You know, I noticed myself, you know, looking at guys more, and I started physically changing, and the world started looking different, and I started seeing other ways I could make myself feel better, basically giving the power to everything. People, especially at this point, please like me and let me be. And well, I like that cute guy, and he liked me. I wouldn't like him anymore, and I'd like this other cute guy. And then it was really just more about getting them to like him and bye, you know. And that is so heartless, you know. But I think about it, it's all that all about me thing, which is at the root of this disease. You know, I got to feel better. Sorry it's hurting you along the way, but I got to, you know. And later, it got a lot more devastating when I was drinking. And, you know, I was really not feeling good about what I was doing, but it was in the name of alcohol as my master, and I'm sorry. But when I took a drink, my first drink at 14, like I said, it was when it was safe to walk up to Safeway International and ask these folks to buy us Boone's Farm. That's the only time I drank Boone's Farm. That was that first drink. I guess right from the get-go, I wanted something different. But, and I didn't get profoundly drunk. The thing that was for me was it was something different. It felt good going in, and I saw other people doing it and the way they looked when they were, and I wanted to do that. Now, well, there's drinking in my household. My parents were these social drinkers. My dad liked to drink. My mom grew up in alcoholism, so she didn't like it, so she's one of those folks that made a drink and just, like, what was the point in making the drink, Mom? Because she'd end up throwing out the first drink, you know, and I used to think that before I even drank, you know, so. But, I drank with my friend that night, and all I could think about was, let's do it again. You know, so I didn't have any huge, like, throwing up story or getting in trouble or blacking out from the first drink, but it sure did open up some doors. And that was my mission all of a sudden. I had a new mission. I was on a quest. This could lead me to feeling better. So I used that to open up all the doors, be invited to all the parties, get to know everybody around me, and I did. So all through high school, that's what I did. I met everybody, was invited to everything, hung out in the smoking area, and even tried to join a sorority once, even though I didn't even enjoy that stuff, even liked it, what it stood for, but all in the name of being a part of and the parties. I mean, I would go totally against so many things I believed in, pretty innocent in high school. Later in life, not so. But, or, you know, over the next 10 years. But anyway, by the time I was a senior in high school, I'd been getting in a lot of trouble, as we do, and doing a lot of things and asking questions later and things like that. And just my mom and my parents were very tolerant. And at this point, my spiritual connection was zero because I didn't feel like I deserved to have God in my life. You know, I'm going in the church where all the people are that like to party. I mean, that was my motive for picking the church to go to, smoking in the bathroom at the church, you know, going to the youth group and not really going, you know, sneaking out and doing all the stuff we do. So, you know, I was using it as a way to do what I wanted to do. So I didn't feel like it's not that I didn't believe in God. I just didn't feel like I deserved to have him in my life. So it was more of I never disbelieved that he existed. I just didn't think Christy deserved to have him. When I was hit my senior high school, I decided I might clean up my act a little bit, and maybe I did want to go to college and applied late, you know. And I was really great with my family on, like, making them, like, scurry to get things for me. I was just really good at this. Christy created crisis. That's what I called them, you know. And I mean, the whole car is waiting to go somewhere, and I'm up in my room still getting ready, holding everybody up, you know. And just, I had to get, my mother would always say, you know, with you, it was always the last time, the first time. It's my favorite. It's the only time, you know. Everything was so dramatic with me, you know. And I used to write a lot of poetry when I was young, too, because I just was seeking for something I couldn't put my hands around. And alcohol was taking me different places, so maybe I'd find it, even though I didn't know what it was to begin with. You know, it was just that thing, that seeking, I was just looking to fill. But I decided that, the reason I said that is I applied to college late, of course, you know, last minute, hurry up, get it in there, come on, I got to go, you know, cause it's all about me. And meanwhile, you know, never mind, my mom's got three other kids, and she was a really neat, structured lady, so she did it. And I ended up going to Radford College then, university now, and I lasted two big semesters. Imagine that. You know, but I landed there with that mission of meeting as many guys as I could, but more importantly, drinking. because I had been drinking a lot through high school. I had made it my mission to go to all the parties. My parents would have, you know, things that started happening at home where they'd have two tables of bridge and they could tell by the way I'm walking up the steps that I'm drunk, you know, and they got all these friends down there and all that kind of stuff's happening. I was not drinking like my friends, you know, and they noticed that right away. So I say I drank to the effect from the get-go, pretty much like the big book says. And I did. I liked the way it made me feel. I want to get there fast. Give it to me. But there was always that little place in there that I wish I could have stayed, but I always drank it away because I was so anxious to get it that I'd feel it for about 5-10 minutes, and I drank it away. And, of course, because I started blackout drinking in college, and pretty much was a blackout drinker from then on. But in college, a lot of things started happening to me that I say that God showed toll was there that I was feeling, but a lot of things started happening that were filling it with ugliness, and I was feeling bad about myself because I was landing in places with people I didn't know, where's my car, how do I do this, you know, how am I going to get back? I got to know the security guys on a first-name basis because they always happened to let me in my dorm, you know, things like that. And that's not normal for an 18-year-old going away to college, you know, but it was for me. And it was just something I had to do. Now, going to class, if I felt like it. So, needless to say, I flunked out. You know, they asked me to leave. But I had a lot of experiences there that really were dark and ugly, and they just went right along with what I was doing. Because when I drank, I never knew where I was going to land or how much I was going to drink. I even started trying to control what I drank then. They'd have the grain parties. Y'all know the famous grain parties. So I started thinking, well, if I just drank 2 glasses of grain, slow, then it won't hit me as hard. I mean, I'm amazed at the thinking. You know, I'm trying to figure out how alcohol is going to hit me. Never drank any alcohol slow. You know, I do it, and of course somebody say, come on, and I go, oh, you okay, I'm gone. Next thing you know, it's the next morning. What have I done? And then the shame of the embarrassment of having to see the people I was with, because God knows what happened. And they love to tell you, y'all know that. I always say there's people that love to tell you. So I always say I have references. If anybody doesn't believe that I'm in recovery, because they'll look at me and say, I can't believe you ever did that stuff. I said, why would I make it up? Why would I say I did that if I didn't? You know, I'm not ashamed of it today. I can say, sure, I did it, because I'm not ashamed of it. You know, through the process of this program and the way we live, I mean, my God, excitingly, I can say it just hit me last year that I have been sober as long as I drank. That was kind of cool, you know. You didn't think about stuff till I hear a speaker say that, and I'm like, have I? And I thought about it, yeah, I have. That's pretty cool. Because I didn't think I'd live past 30. But anyway, let me speed up a little bit. I left college, went home. Wasn't going back in that structured household. God loved my parents. They were awesome. They were always there. I got to tell you. They were always there. Wonderful people. But I wasn't going back in that structured household. I had freedom, and I needed to do too much stuff. I had things to do. So I moved in with that best friend that we all had that, of course, it lasted 6 big weeks, and it was all her fault. And so ended up moving with them with my cousin who conveniently got divorced. Of course, it's all about me, so I say conveniently, never mind, I'm thinking about her marriage splitting up, you know, I'm thinking, oh, good, I've got somewhere to go. Oh, sorry about your divorce, but hey, now we can go out, you know. And so we're going to bars, and I start my bar drinking, and then I get to know everybody on a first-name basis. I don't even care if friends come with me or not. And I'm going with people that I don't know and doing things and just throwing caution to the wind, all in the name of I got to feel better. Going with one person, leaving with another. Oh, y'all know what I'm talking about because I always see the identification going on, you know, and thank you for doing that. But that's always reassuring. But I already knew I wasn't the only one that did. And if you didn't shake your head, I'd say you're lying. But we all did that stuff, you know, all in the name of feeling better. It all goes with it. And I was really sorry for all the people that I hurt along the way because there were many. Some of them I don't even know who they are, but, you know, I've learned in recovery there are ways to make amends for that, too. But I was very self-absorbed and I was really like a sad person just running around trying to feel happy. And alcohol really, you know, did a number on me. By the time I was 19, I met this guy. I was out drinking. I met this guy through some friends. And he was a guy that had been in my junior high school and been kicked out of the school system, which should have been a red flag for most. But for me, I was like, oh, man, guy for me. You know, somebody that drinks like I do. Somebody that likes to party. Somebody that likes to throw that caution to the wind like me. So we ended up getting together, and he was in the Army, and I used to ride at Fort Monroe. And that was so crazy, the lengths we'll go to. And I had a job, and I'd drive down to Fort Monroe on the weeknight and party and drive back in the middle of the night and wonder why the bosses were saying, "What is wrong with you?" Because I'd look in the mirror going, "I don't see anything wrong." You know, and I'd take that occasional night where I wasn't going to go out. Every morning, of course, I said, "I am not going out tonight." But by 5, I'm on the phone, finding out what everybody's doing. And I'd eat a piece of cheese here and there, just make myself feel like I was giving myself some nutrition. And I was smoking cigarettes and drinking. I mean, that was it. You know, and then I was just partying hard. That was it. And doing all that stuff we do. Anyway, I ended up marrying him. He went away to Germany, and he asked me in the mail, and we got married. I loved the romance. I was a reader. I read a lot growing up, and I'd personalize all the stories I'd read and just say, "Oh, yeah," and just get so caught up. And I just loved to read, you know. My mom exposed us to that very early, which I'm grateful for, because it really helped me academically, because I wasn't applying myself a lot of times, and because of that, it helped me get through school. But I, would personalize our stories, and I just love that romance. I was like, "Ooh, he's asking me to marry him in the mail, and going to plan this big wedding. I'm the only daughter. My mom's ready to spare no expense," and we did. And I get a call from his captain in Germany the night before I'm going to mail the invitation saying, "You might not want to do that. He's in a lot of trouble, blah, blah, blah." I'm like, "We'll just postpone the wedding." Mom had to reorder the invitations. I married him anyway, and it was just what it should have been. Two drunks getting married, and it lasted 5.5 years. Which is amazing. It's probably only because we had 3 kids during that time. I was 25 when I had my 3rd child and 26 when we got divorced. And there was a lot of drinking, a lot of craziness, a lot of insanity, I was exposed to a lot of stuff I'd never been around before. You know, alcohol just, you know, it affects people differently. A lot of stuff went on in that home. I was really starting to trade my soul at that time for alcohol, because I was putting up with things that really didn't need to put up with, but I did, and you do in the name of that. And the way I was feeling about myself, I mean, I didn't feel good about myself. I'd never been okay in my own skin. I definitely wasn't. You know, I had these 3 little beautiful babies, and I'm thinking they're going to fix it, because they're 4, 3, and 1, and I'm 26. You know, and I don't have a job, and we're getting a divorce, which actually was for the best based on all the insanity that was going on. But I had little heroes along the way. I always like to talk about those people that validate our drinking. Like, I had a pediatrician I went to see when everything was going crazy, and I was, like, sort of telling people that things weren't so great. And he said, I just had my 3rd child, and everything's crazy at home. And he's like, "Look, this is the secret. 4 o'clock, before he gets there, drink a glass of wine. That'll help." I'm like, "Bottle of wine, and the big one, who cares if he comes home," right? And that's what it was, you know? You know, so that, yeah, he validated my drinking. I'm doing this to feel better, you know? So that, you know, validates what I'm doing, and I always look for those people. And then when I had the people in my life that would tell me the truth, "Bah, you're not my friend. Oh, you don't want what's best for me. You know what you said to them." I did this, you know, it's like, you're out of my life. Like that, I could cut people out. They were telling me the truth, and I was good at it, because I didn't want to hear it. I wanted to hear what I wanted to hear. Because don't you understand, I'm a sad, lonely girl. I just want to be happy. I just want to be happy. My parents were wonderful through all of this. I got to say, my whole family was. The next few years were A-G double hockey stick. That's what I say. I learned to say it when my kids were little, so I still say it. So, but spell it like that. But I didn't think I'd live to be 30. And the next 4 years were insane. I'm telling you, I moved in an apartment. We sold our house. I moved in an apartment. I was drinking from morning till night. You know, these beautiful little children. Again, thank God for my parents who were young. They're with me. I love those kids. Had nothing to do with those kids. My drinking had absolutely nothing to do with those kids. It had to do with me being an alcoholic. So I'm on my quest. I got to feel better. I got to get a job eventually. Because, see, we first split up. I told him, I said, "Well, you got to give me some transition money. Because I can't just be jumping into working. And these kids are used to me being around. So I need some transition time." So the stuff we could come up with. He didn't buy into it very long, but he did, you know, in the beginning. And I did end up having to get a job. But I had this, you know, I said God had the 16-year-old move in underneath me. She turned into of course, I'm already thinking, babysitter. She babysat for me so much, she moved her mattress up in my apartment. And I was going out drinking every night. And I always make sure my kids are around good people. Thank God, or people. I don't know about good, but people. You know, but they were taking care of but I was going to bars a lot. And I knew, I was laying in bed one night after I'd been drinking all day and taking the kids to the pool and living this hard, sad life that I thought I had. And I'm sitting there, I'm laying in bed, and I'm going, you know, it was just the wrong guy. That was it. It was just the wrong guy. So I'm still giving the power to people. I'm still thinking a person's going to fix my life. You know, it's still outside of me that's going to fix my life. You know, and my parents are watching me going, what are you doing? You know, and they were like, my mom, I think, saw it but didn't want to see it. And she was really, she's a neat lady, but she still was kind of like, don't let the neighbors know kind of stuff. You know, she tried to minimize things. We weren't that bad. I'm like, Mom, it was bad. And thank God she doesn't know everything. But so I went out drinking with my cousin. You know, and we went into Cimarron Rose, this place down there. It's not even open anymore. Some crazy bar. It was packed. And there was this, of course, I met him, and there was probably 500 people in that place. And he had just broken up with somebody, too. How about that? And I just thought that was God. Yeah, he just put us together. And I must have had the magnet, you know, come get me, I'm a fool. You know, I'm a woman that will give you the power. You know, because that's what I did. And for the next 3.5 years, it was pretty bad. It was worse than the marriage. I really did trade my soul during that relationship. I did things I never even thought I'd do. I mean, I woke up and I was everything I hated. I was a very lonely, sad lady. I'm riding around in the car watching people driving to work or doing whatever they're going to go do and wishing I could be those people, thinking I'd give $1 million just to be somebody driving to work looking forward to the day. Because every day when I woke up, here we go, I got to do it again. And it got, I don't know when it happened to the point where I just didn't want to do it anymore, but I couldn't stop. And I got scared. Because, you know, I'm in and out of jobs, and this whole period was kind of crazy. I'm leaving jobs because you know when they're going to fire you. You just know. So you leave because you know they're going to ask you to leave. And they wanted things like working 8 hours, earn your money. And they wanted it in a row. I mean, you know, they wanted you to at least work a few days a week, you know. And I would leave, and the delude, you know, my thinking with the lunch hour. I always tell this because it's so true. It's the way I could trick myself into believing my own stuff. Nobody else did, of course, but I did. And I'd get indignant if you didn't. And I just didn't understand why you didn't. And now I look back and say, God, like, day. Now I've talked to some people myself, and since I've been sober, that were kind of reminded me of myself back then. And I'd go, oh, my God, how I sounded. But I show them patience and tolerance because I know that's exactly what people did for me. But I would leave at 1, and about 1:45, I'd say, you know what, I think I left that 1:15. And then it'd be about 2 o'clock, I'd say, no, it's probably about 1:30. So, of course, I'm gone longer than I'm supposed to, and little things like that make people not want you around anymore. I was lying. I was on the phone a lot with personal calls. I was smoke breaks. I was missing a lot of time. I really wasn't looking so good, you know. You know, God's good. Sometimes he gave me some real moments of clarity, and I saw what I really looked like, and I'd be like, oh, my gosh, I got to clean up myself. But I went through a lot of jobs over the next few years, and the relationship with that guy got worse. And I'm grateful to say that, and I moved in with my parents 3 different times, and I'm going to fast forward to that the last time. Because there's, you know, a lot of things happened. I got in trouble with the law. I stole my mom's checkbook and wrote bad checks on an account that was closed. You know, it was all in the name of, I got to have some money. You know, I'd have rent due, it'd be $350. I could have the $340 of it, and I'd have the other 10 and say, well, I can't pay it. I don't have the other 10 bucks. You know, instead of mailing it, like we know, we would logic, but it's, I couldn't pay it. I just can't do it. You know, I don't have that other $10. So that's the kind of way, the way I was thinking, you know. And it was any way to justify using the money for my own self. And I take my children into Toys R Us because I felt like such a lousy mother. God, I felt like so lousy as a mother. And I just love those kids. God, I treasure them. They're just my babies. And I'm watching these beautiful children terrified this is the life they're going to have. And I'm taking them in Toys R Us and I'm saying, each of you can buy a $20 toy. Now, that wasn't for them. That was for me. That was so I'd feel better as a parent for a couple minutes. Because that's all it lasted anyway. Everything was a Band-Aid. Nothing was anything that stayed with any permanency. Because it wasn't a solution. It was just a quick thing to make me feel better for a minute. You know, I'm crying all the time. I'm looking at them. I'm thinking, is this the life we're going to have? Of course, the drama. We're living at my parents' the last time. I had a brother. My last youngest brother was still living there. He's 17. And I'm stealing money out of his room to spend, and he's saving for his insurance, and he's spitting at me, cussing at me, deservedly. He's, you know, I'm stealing from everybody in the house. They're hiding their money, you know. So I'm just going down fast, and I'm sitting in one of the most profound moments for me was when I was sitting in Mom's kitchen, and I'm looking at my kids, and I can still remember it like it was yesterday, that I'm looking at them thinking, you know, I love these kids, but I don't even feel good feelings anymore. I mean, I was just like a void of a person. It was just empty. It had just taken over my whole body, I was just nothing. I probably weighed 100 pounds if that. I'm breaking out, the alcohol's coming out of my skin. I had gotten to the point where I was drinking even when I didn't want to. I'm negotiating with God every day, saying, all right, if I can just stop. Finally got rid of that guy out of my life because I didn't even want anybody around. Started going out drinking by myself, daring people to come over. I remember finding a piece of paper that said, get help on it, that I had written and was sitting in a bar. I found that like a few years ago, and that was really neat to run across that. You know, but I was so desperate and sad. And I'm in this job, and I've got these people coming up to me. And this was the last job I had before I got sober. And I know God put me there because all these people are starting to tell me about their spouses that got sober at St. John's Hospital, a treatment center. And I'm going, you know, that's great, out of the blue. And I'm going, why are they telling me all this? You know, I said, well, I'm happy for them. And then I started, inside I'm screaming out, tell me more. But I've got the pride thing, you know, what do you mean? You know, that arrogance, that, But then God's, you know, I'm looking in the mirror one day at work, and I'm really seeing what I'm looking at. And I'm like, who is that girl? My God. All friends were gone. People in the family were only there because they had to be. I had a brother right under me, 3 years younger. He was the one Mom always called to help bail me out. My parents were constantly bailing me out, get me out of jail, pay my rent, do this. I'm at work, and they're moving the stuff out of my apartment that I was evicted from with the sheriff's on the front yard. That's a perfect image of what I put people through in my life. I didn't participate in my own life. Other people did it for me. And, you know, I'm so grateful when I got sober that I could actually participate in my own life, you know, because I wasn't. I wasn't doing it. You know, and they were bailing me constantly. And I'm at that last job, and I made that phone call to St. John's because they said, you know, on the sly, and I'm talking real low, and I'm answering yes to all the questions, and the guy's like, you need to get over here. And I'm like, you know, and the surrender hadn't totally happened, but it was starting to happen. And my parents said, Christy, you need to go. We'll watch the kids. You need to get out of here. Enough's enough. Too much. You know, and I'm glad. I thanked them. I thanked him for that, because when they did, I left, came back a week later, and she said, you can come back, but you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know where she got that from, and I didn't even ask. I was so desperate that I just said, okay. And I went, sat in the back, and I'm listening to these people describing how I'm feeling inside, and I ain't never met them. I'm going, whoa. And that was the hope. And that's why I think it's so important always to really give that hope, you know, when we share, that we don't know who's listening. We don't know who's watching. The reason I say it's my faith, you know, I can't think of anywhere I'd rather be than with you fine people is because a guy told me one time that's why he kept coming back to our home group. He said, you always said that every week. I want to know why. I said, you never know who's watching, and you never know who's listening, because people are hanging on. I mean, I'm like, oh, my God. I didn't pick up a white chip then. I wasn't done, but I had a seed was planted, and I couldn't stop thinking about it because it was a good message there. It was, you can have this too. Here's our phone numbers. Give us a call. And I'm like going, nobody wanted me to call them in a long term. And y'all know that. So the only people, like I said, were in my life were people that had to be. And so I went home and I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I went to another meeting. And then I had made the phone call. And I remember my boss at work saying that she had gone through a tough time one time and she had to do whatever it took. And I heard that when I went to this. And I went to another meeting and I thought, I need to do something. What am I going to do? See, then I was scared. Then I was scared. I thought, what if I can't have it? I got in my head. You know, my head does not want what's best for me even today. And so my head is going off about, well, I don't know if you can have it. They might have it, but you can't have it. You know, I'm like, so anyway, the great thing is God is very powerful. And when it's time, it's time. And I'm a big believer in that. And then one of Bill Wilson's writings, he says, we awake or we die. And I awoke, April 11th, 1988. I woke up that morning and knew something could be different for the first time ever. And I got up, and it's almost like I knew it was God moving me, because it was not me. Because if I'd wanted a solution, I would have been in it a long time prior, because I sure was not enjoying my life. I was hating myself with a passion and wouldn't look in the eye or nothing. So I went into my job and I said, I'm dying. I need to take a leave of absence. I don't care if I lose the job. And I called my mama at work and she's crying. She said, yes, we'll watch the kids. Thank God. You know, and I got some affairs straight and I said bye to my children. And my brother, the 17-year-old, who was probably so grateful to get me out of that house. I hate to think about what I put him through. Well, my whole family, my father, everybody. But because they're all wondering, what, you know, why won't you just stop? You know, at that point, they didn't understand it. They're not going to, because they're not alcoholics. Why can't you just stop? You know, they'd say, because I'm enjoying all this misery too much, you know. But it's like they didn't understand, you know, and it's sad because they don't. But they were so grateful. I was very blessed with support from my family. My brother drove me out to St. John's Hospital on River Road, and probably for a lot of reasons. One, he could use my car for a month because we couldn't keep our cars. He threw $10 down on my hand and ran for the hills and thought, thank God I can eat in the kitchen again. Because he was eating his meals in his bedroom. Because he didn't want to sit down there with me and all my whatever was going on. So anyway, I did go in St. John's Hospital April 11th, 1988 and woke up. And I drank that day. So April 12th is my sobriety date. And by the grace of God and a desperation that was definitely a gift, I'm still standing here today. Because the gift of it was, and is, that I was so close to dying and so wiped out, and I gave up and no more fight left and no guns, the big guns are gone, everything's gone, hands by my side, no more fighting. There was none left. I was just a girl that was dying and wanted to live. I wanted to live. I wanted to stay sober more than I wanted to drink was the bottom line. And when I woke up the next morning, I just said, show me. You know, and it hasn't been like this big picnic. I know I'm very, yay, but see, I got sober to be happy. I did. Happy, joyous, and free, what the book tells us. And that doesn't mean life's happy every day and yay, yay, yay. And I was never a cheerleader. People always ask me that, and I go, no. But I tried out once because I wanted to be included, but I didn't make it, and it's not me anyway because I was off smoking and doing all that other craziness. So I come to find out if I would have fit in just fine. But anyway, anyway, I did, April 12, 1988 is a very special day because, you know, I was told the minute you become well and you ought to start changing, you know, and so I woke up in that treatment center and I was like, a lot of things happened to me there. They introduced us to AA because they took us out to AA meetings. That's why I like that treatment center. There, and I met people that brought meetings in because it was in Richmond, close to, there, because I've met them and then knew them on the outside when I got out. So it was really cool. That's why I believe in, you know, the treatment center, the treatment facilities and corrections and all the different committees that we have to carry the message all over, because it's important that people get it and maybe can see a face that can connect with. It's important. But anyway, those 28 days were very, I learned a lot. And that's great. It would have kept me sober, of course, we all know that, because the book tells us that. But I mean, it's not a good, but I learned a lot. But also was, like I said, taking the meetings. And I drank coffee for the first time in my life. Of course, I had to be different because I wasn't going to drink the decaf. So I found it where they hid the real coffee in the kitchen. So I was known as the coffee dealer. See, I'm still, so I got to be something. So I'd sneak and make the real coffee and tell my friends which one isn't. I'd be signaling, you know. They never figured out he was doing that. But I thought, you know, that was so funny. You know, I was 30. I turned 31 in treatment. Had a birthday there. You know, I didn't think I was going to live to be 30. And I turned 31 in treatment. And I still got a little bunny they gave me, all the people I was in there with. And the sign was very appropriate. It said, I need loving. And I still got that. And that's very special. You know, we know so much about each other before we even talk. I mean, my favorite AA says, you know, we know 75% about you before we even talk to you. The other 25%... pretty much know that too. So that's what's so cool, you know, because we all thought and drank and felt the same way. But that set me off and sprang me off into living for something that I was not familiar with. And it was very important to me to participate in my life. When I got sober, I had to accept that I also was a single mother of three little kids that I loved dearly. And it was time for me to step up to the plate, stop letting other people take care of my life. So when I was in there, I learned to eat meals. And I gained about 20 pounds and started looking human You know, and I had all this court stuff hanging over me, and their dad was never really in their life much, and sadly, he never really has been then, but of course, he took that opportunity because he didn't want to pay child support to come out of the woodwork and say, oh, she's an alcoholic, and the judge is like, why am I going to take somebody's kids that's trying to get their life together? And that's the good news about alcoholism, too. In the courts, they recognize it now, and they realize that people can get better, and that's a good thing. They realize that we can get in recovery and continue to recover as long as we do the things that we do. And that says that some good public information went on to that judge because he knew about Alcoholics Anonymous and knew that it works and that a transformation can happen and see people do it. So that didn't happen either, which I wasn't worried about, but I lost my job. Big surprise. But, you know, I really, you know, God's in charge and he has landed me so many wonderful places. So when I got out, of course, I was with my parents, and my kids, when they'd come visit me, they were looking at me different, like, wow. You know, they could see the change in Mom. Actually looked alive, you know, and I was so excited just to be alive. And they taught me, one thing I'll give the place, you know, the big book was used a lot in the meetings that the people brought in. So we introduced to the big book and the prayer and just the meditation and the whole be quiet. Because I'm a fast-moving person, and I was always in next week, and I'm still back here. You know, I go through my week so fast, I couldn't tell you what happened. And I always have to have a lot of people around me and a lot going on. And those clamors in my head were constantly, nah. And I have really learned in recovery how to enjoy and be where I'm at. You know, some of the greatest gifts I've received are being okay in my own skin and being where I'm at, right when I'm supposed to be, so I can enjoy this life that God's given me, because it's a great life, and I'm robbing myself if I don't slow down enough and live it. So when I got out, it swung me off into living, like I said, and I'm living with my folks, and I got a sponsor and got a home group and was a coffee maker, and she said, you get there early and make that coffee and you stand at the door for 30 minutes and greet everybody that comes in that meeting. And I did. And I didn't ask a lot of questions because that desperation, like I said, was a gift. And I was so awed by how much better I felt just in that 28. I mean, I was looking at people with 30 days when I first got sober going, daggone, 30 days without a drink. I can't even believe that. You know, and it, you know, and one day leads to two to three to four, and all of a sudden you got weeks, months, and we know if we do this thing, it grows and it turns into years, which floors me still today when I think about it. It's very humbling, and I try to live my life grateful because it is so humbling. But so and all of a sudden, you know, I was excited about being alive. I wanted to live, tell me what to do, went to meetings all the time, took the kids if I had to. You know, I hear people say, well, I got kids, I can't go. I'm like, cook, you drank. You had kids? Sometimes you leave them alone. No, I take the kids with them. Set them over in the room next door. Let them color. My kids got to know my friends in AA because I was learning to live. And I don't want them to feel like it was like two separate things and it was an either or. This was my life. You know, I wasn't at step, you know, learning about practicing principles in all my affairs. But I had examples of that around me that showed me how to do that and to take it home even from the get-go. This is who I am. It's got to give. You know, I need to live a spiritual life and a principled life, and the steps will walk me out of that hell, help the transformation happen so that I can. But that didn't mean that I didn't start doing things different from the get-go. Didn't mean that I didn't, you know, I didn't ever want them to feel like it was, well, you know, this is Mom's little part of her life, because it's not. It was the way I was supposed to live. And it's just been amazing because of that. But I was blessed with really good people that took me under their wing when I got here. They were like, come on, this is what we do. And we go sat up at Aunt Sarah's for hours with the waitresses getting mad at us because all we're doing is drinking coffee. You know, and going to all the stuff in town. And now when my children were young, I did things locally. I got very involved in my home group. And when I was a year sober, they asked me if I wanted to be the GSR. And I said, sure. So I got involved and learned about the service structure. And I had already learned some through my sponsor, but I got to experience it. Got involved with intergroup. And I'm not going to give you a resume of what I've done through the years, but I'm going to say God has, you know, I'm a willing soul, and he has sure used me. I believe that he qualifies us for what we're supposed to do. It's not up to me to try to figure it out. He's going to say, Billy called on the phone, said, would you come up and speak? Sure. God's letting me know, go speak. Meet some new friends. It's great to be here. You know, this is what we do. We pass it on. We share it. It's how we live our lives. So, and that's why I'm here, because that was shown to me, not just told, but I like the busy people. They're the people I hung around with. They're the people that are doing something. I really believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is for people to do it. You know, you can want it, and need it all day long, but if you ain't doing nothing, you can forget it. It ain't going to happen. You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, that job, they're not going to knock on the door and say, hey, will you come work for us? And the money's not going to come falling out of the sky. And I heard a guy in treatment at one of those meetings they brought in that was 2 years sober say that. Now, see, he left a profound effect on me by what he was sharing. I've got to put legs on my prayers. If I want it to work, I've got to put legs on it. I've got to get out there and take the actions. And that's what I did. I got a job. Because my sponsor said, well, I know you want that apartment, but we do things in order around here. So you have to get a job first. So I went on a lot of job interviews and landed somewhere that for 5 years. And these were people that believed in giving people second chances, that were honest about what they've been doing. Because I can promise you that resume, I didn't put a whole lot on there. You know, I didn't need to put all these, you know, little blank spots. He just wanted to know where I'd been for 30 days because where had I been? And I had to fess up about that and had some legal things going on. And he said, you know, you're honest about where you're at in your life here. And I literally started my life over. I mean, I had folks now. Remember, they could have said, here's the money, do it. But I didn't want to. I learned about Tradition 7 from the get-go, self-supporting through our own contributions in my personal life. I learned those traditions are about me and how I live my life. And I learned that one right away. I'd had a car accident in 86, and it didn't settle to 88, and I'd really messed it up by a lot of stuff I was doing, so I got, like, the minimal amount of money. But the great thing that happened was that it settled after I got sober, and I was able to... talking to my sponsor about it, and I said, you know, I'd like to give my parents three-quarters of that money as a financial amend. Just, I know I'm not there yet, but because they just did so much, and I told them how much it was, and it was a good amount of money. They didn't need that money, but they knew I needed to do it, and it felt so good to want to do that. And I only kept enough for my children, and I had to maybe have a deposit and get it. And I'll never forget, I bought myself an answering machine. I'd never had one. Because people were actually going to call me back. I can remember running home and seeing how many blinks were doing. I'd get so excited that there were blinks. People were called. I want to hear called. You know, and then when you could check it from work and call, you know, I was upset. You know how obsessive about that, checking all the time. Who called? But I also learned that you got to call people back if they call you. You know, I learned things like that about, you know, don't give your number out unless you plan on calling the people back. And if you say call anytime, that means 3 a.m. Wake up and talk. You know, that's what we do. So I did. I learned some really neat stuff like that. We did end up moving out. And that first apartment was a blessing. A lady gave us a chance that had needed help herself at one time. I'd gone through, looking through a lot. I mean, imagine this. I had bad credit. This is the girl that used to throw the bills away without even opening them. I didn't even open my mail. It's just like, I can't pay it anyway. I'm not looking at it. You know, because all it's going to do is make me feel bad, you know. So all it did was make me feel bad, so I didn't do it, you know. So I ended up getting, you know, landing somewhere in this first apartment. I just loved it. It was just an amazing story because the children, I lived there a couple years, and I can remember walking through there going, this is my place. And I'm just pinching myself because I had done it. You know, I had done the work, and because of people like yourself had shown me and said, you can do it. And if you just take the actions, you'll land where you're supposed to, and all those things instead of worrying about it, being consumed with it, and messing it up. Because, see, I've been running around over-explaining my situation, which we tend to, you know, I wanted to be given a chance so bad. I was saying too much information, and the looks I got, people were like, who is this insane woman looking at me? And so my sponsor said, just keep it simple, Christy. So the last time I went in and said to the lady, I just said, you know, I'm trying to get my life together. I need help. I just need somebody to give me a chance. And she said, I've been there. Give me a deposit at church. So, you know, I've learned that those are my early recovery things that happened. And the last one I'm going to say about early recovery is, you know, I used to lie even when I didn't have to. I got such a habit of lying before I got sober. God knows. Thank, you know, God for honesty where we don't have to remember what we say. You know, just... you are who you are, you say what you say, and that's it. You just don't have to remember what you said, if you're being honest. And I remember staying in a meeting real late one night, and I was still living with my parents, hadn't moved out in that apartment yet, and I'm driving home panicking about what I'm going to tell my parents. What am I going to tell them? Oh, my God, it's 10:30. Meeting was over at 9. What am I going to say? And then it hit me. The truth. Tell them the truth. So I went in, and that was a very profound moment for me. That was one of those early moments that meant a lot, left such an impression, and I went in there like, we weren't worried about it, and I'm thinking, it's yet another reminder that it was good I was worried about it. You know, that stuff means something to me today as much as it did then. Those early experiences and the experiences I had going through the steps, because meanwhile, I'm going through the steps with my sponsor. And I'm starting to do things for people without caring if I get anything back. Because I used to have a big old rope attached to everything I did for anybody. I can tell you straight up, if I was doing it, there was something attached and I was going to get something out of it. I started doing things and not caring if anybody knew. You know, really neat things. I was like, wow, I'm doing that? I'm thinking like that? I mean, I think I have a good heart and a good soul. But I didn't know. And I started having a relationship with God, a relationship, like the big book talks about. You know, through the third step and putting it into action, doing 4 and 5. You know, coming face to face with myself for the first time ever. Because I always pretended it was some other girl that did all that stuff. That wasn't me. I didn't do all that. And so I did that. And, that, you know, all of a sudden there's promises. That, you know, I can look the world in the eye. My fears are falling away. You know, and I'm moving through 6 and 7, and I'm asking him to remove the things that are blocking me from being of maximum service to him and my fellows. And I learned that the 4 step's not about feeling better. It's about removing the stuff that's blocking me from God and you and me. You know, it was just so amazing, the transformation that happened and how I really felt more a part of, you know, when I was doing that. And being able to look people in the eye and make amends and feel better about, you know, and having relationships with people that I thought were gone. You know, I had that black and white thinking, oh, my God, it's over because I did blah, blah. Not going in with any expectations, but knowing that I was going into right or wrong. And then learning to live in today with 10, 11, and 12. You know, learning about, I just love steps 10, 11, and then 12, the spiritual awakening happens as the result. I really believe that in practicing, keyword, practicing these principles in all our affairs. You know, I had to remember that I got to throw that yardstick away. I don't need to be measuring myself against you. I need to be me. I need to be the person God would have me be. And I believe that this is what it's about. I started sponsoring people, becoming more involved in service, and my children were growing up, and I'm just watching them grow. And thank God I was in recovery when they were teenagers, I can tell you. And now they're 26, 25, and 23. And it's been a great ride. It has just been an amazing ride. We have had a lot of experiences together, and I have experienced a lot in recovery with, you know, I've experienced good and bad. You know, I've had people die, and I've had people get married, like my daughter, who got married in May, which was one of the best days of my life. My boys walked her in. I joined her at the altar, and we gave her away. What a great experience. I mean, I would have missed all of that. I married the man of my dreams. See, I don't have a good picker, and I just don't pick out good guys for me. And I really believe I don't. I do not pick out good guys, but God does. And I believe that if God has every part of my life, He's going to put the people in my life that I'm supposed to have. So that's why giving it to God, I really have had to learn through the years what that really means. I can say it, but am I really doing it? Am I living it? Am I really by my actions? And that's why staying involved in this program, working with sponsees, with my sponsor, doing my prayers every day, asking Him to direct my thinking, to divorce me from all that stuff that gets me messed up, and really practicing these principles and not getting caught up in the outcome, but just the effort, and learning to be in the moment, and really feeling good about who I am. That's when I meet the people and I land the places I'm supposed to. And I met my husband, Dennis, in service work. And we got married 5 years ago in May. It was 5 years ago. And we had known each other for 4 years. And he was a good friend. We had so much fun in service together. And we fell in love. And I can't put words on it. It's just better than the dream. That's what I usually say. And it's a great thing. It gets better every day. And it's all about living a good life and experiencing God's gifts. I've got great relationships with my children. And I've got a bunch of girls that I sponsor. And we have a book study at my house on Thursday nights. And it's so awesome just to watch people's lives transform. Because I'm a big believer in getting involved in the circle. You know, if you stay in the middle of the circle and triangle, you're going to be all right. I really believe that. And it's what you're doing, you're getting out of it. Whatever you're doing, you're going to get out of it. But if you're not doing it and you want it, it's not going to work. And so I'm in a job where I work with the jails, and I coordinate all the volunteer programs in the 6 jails. All of these things are, God has put me there through lots of different events. When we moved away in 2003, Dennis got transferred, and we had mentioned that. I've got a couple minutes, so I'm going to tell you this, because God is so cool. You know what's so great? AA is everywhere. And what's neat, too, is that we had a lot of people that I met when I was here in Richmond before we moved that had relocated. Relocation is not easy. I was 15 years sober when we relocated, and it was hard. I went from 300 meetings a week to 30. It was a whole new ball game. But it was what I made it. And my sponsor said, take what you know and share your experience, strength, and hope. And just stick your hand out and do what you did when you first came in. Get a lot of phone numbers. Because when I first got sober, I'd go into meetings alone and get three women's phone numbers and call them. That was how I put myself out there. That's how I got to know people. So I went to a lot of meetings and got to know a lot of ladies. And then, you know, Dennis would get to know the men. And all of a sudden, we were involved. I mean, it's AA. We love each other. It's everywhere. But I had to remember that it wasn't going to be Richmond. It was going to be another experience. But the fundamentals are the same. And it's all about passing it on and sharing new ideas. Because we had been doing some things in Richmond that we were able to share down there. And we started a home group when we were down there called the Rule 62 group, which was kind of cool. That is important, not to take yourself so damn serious. That's what it says. I'm just quoting. But it's a good group, and it's going strong. We're actually going back next month. Dennis has been invited to speak for one of the guys that helped us start the group. It's our anniversary, and we're going to go see our old friends. We stay connected. You know, I've traveled all over with Dennis, gone to meetings all over the United States. We've been to the internationals, the last two. Just loving everything for what's here to offer. But when we were in North Carolina, we first moved, I was, you know, if you got something going on, I believe let people know. And I don't mean like tell, I don't mean about stuff. I mean like I needed a job. So I was letting people know, hey, I'm looking for work, if anybody knows. And I mean, I'm talking before meeting or after meeting talk. Well, this principal of an elementary school comes up to me and says, Christy, I want you to teach in my school. Now, I didn't mention, when I went to college when I was 18, I wanted to be a teacher. I thought that dream was long gone, just like all the other dreams I've had, because I drank them away and because I wasn't thinking about it. And I said, I can't. I don't have any school. He said, there's an equivalency test you can take, you know, work keys, and if you score high enough, you can be a teacher's assistant. I said, great. He said, there's only one catch. You got to drive school bus. So I said, okay, because I've learned in recovery, we're not always going to like everything about something we want to do. But we just have to do it. If we really want to do it, then we accept all of it, and we do it. And it was a great experience. What turned out was I had my own classroom. I taught the kids that needed extra, and I sure know about helping people that need extra. We had a great experience that year teaching. And so God, if I hadn't stuck around and done the things we do and just continued to place these principles in my life and help others and do and pray and ask for God's will, and I try to map it out and plan it out, how did I know 15 years sober I was going to be able to teach? I would have sold myself so short. Lots of things like that have happened in my life. You know, I married the man of my dreams, like I mentioned. I got great relationships with my kids, and that is something that's been a real gift for me. I like myself. I like who I'm becoming every day. I really believe in this program and in this process. And I know that I'm human, too, and I have to allow myself that. But I want to continue to grow. I want to stay on the beam. You know, I always say, people say, you know, I want to, you know, have what you have. I said, I don't have anything you can't have. The highest you get here sober, because God's in charge. Jump on a train and let's go. If you want it, let's do it, because it's a great life. And there's many, many stories I could share, which means that I have made the best of my 18 and a half years. And hopefully, if I see you out somewhere, we can share, swap stories. The great thing is that I'm alive, I feel good about who I am, and I'll close with this. You know, I've heard lots of things about what humility is. It's being teachable. You know, that's a big thing. But, you know, we were reading the other day, and I really like the humility for me is that right now, on this Sunday, 7:05, because I said I respected the clock and I'm going to stop talking, that I'm right here where I'm supposed to be with you, accepting me for who I am and where I am, accepting you for who you are and where you are, and being okay with it. And that's very humbling to me, and I like that because God is here. And and it's a great life, and I just appreciate spending this hour with you. Thanks.